I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right. Hello. Welcome back to a Thursday edition of the Chase Thomas podcast. It's Thursday, so you know what that means. It's the full ride on the Chase Thomas podcast. I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, which I've said my full name at least four times in this 20-second intro to tonight's show, but it's Thursday. So Matt Green, fellow University of North Georgia alumni, is also here. Matt, good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening, sir. You got to get that that brand recognition out there. You know, just keep saying your name and eventually it'll catch on. You know, people are like, I know I heard that somewhere.
Yeah, it's like
Chase
that.
Thomas. I know I've heard that name.
Yeah, he said it like 19 times on his show. Is that the show that he hosts? The Chase Thomas podcast?
also him? for the Georgia State fans out there, every day is Thursday. All right. They're the Thurs.
What just happened? What did you just
say? It's every day is Thursday, man. The Thurs, Georgia State. That's they, the Panthers. That's they just call them the Thurs.
This is not a real thing. You just made this up, right?
No, it's a real thing. It's every day is Thursday. It's like a legit like spirit thing that Georgia State does.
There's no way this is real.
The Thurs, yeah. I remember when we were at the College Ball of Fame, there was like the little thing on Marietta Street, little football fest, mm-hmm. and they had like GSU, State Not Southern, GSU. Like they're big on the GSU rivalry with Georgia Southern.
It's a lot bigger than I thought.
Like a childish rivalry. Like I'm like, it's not too serious. You guys don't hurt each other.
Well, it's a better rivalry than Georgia Tech. Like Georgia Tech's not really a rivalry. Like, it's just kind of, it's just two different programs. Like, GSU, the battle for the real GSU, like, Southern and State are close. Like, they're
like,
close.
They should have some kind of rule. Like, like a petty bet or something. Mm. Like, whoever wins the year before gets to claim GSU for the entire year or something like that. Like, that would be awesome.
You know that'd be cringy, though. The stuff that would come out for the full year we'd see, we're like, oh. The olds got a handle of all of this and they're taking over these Twitter accounts and it's just the real GSU. I don't know. I couldn't do it. Do you remember the Brookwood Where You At and the Grayson Where You At videos?
Oh, the Brookwood sounds familiar. It was Brookwood Parkview going back and forth.
No.
Brookwood Grayson?
Yeah, it's Brookwood Grayson.
Oh, that was a little after my time.
It was after my time too. And you know what's sad? This is how we know we're old, because I'm turning 30 this weekend, Matt, is that it was past my time. And I was looking at this and I was like, yeah, what year was that? And then I was like, what? This was like 4 years after I'd graduated that they did this. And I was like, oh my God.
So even this is like, what, 8, 9 years old?
Wait, say it again?
So even this is like 8, 9 years ago or something like that?
And I was like, there's no way it's been that long. And I'm like, oh my God, it's almost been a decade since this video came out. That's crazy. Yeah.
Dude, I saw that. Yeah. Like, I thought that the same thing, like when they showed that Tiger Woods shot last week, that one that hung on the lip and then went in, I don't know, it was like 15 or 16 or something at the Masters. They said that was like 16 years ago. I was like, there's no way. I remember that. That wasn't that long ago. I'm so old.
Yeah. Did that cross over with your 30th birthday or no?
Oh, taking shots. I'm a strong 31, all right? You know,
yeah.
I'm not still in my 20s like you young whippersnappers over there, but yeah, we're holding it down our 30s. Yeah. You'll understand one day. You'll be there.
I mean, I'll be there on Sunday. I'm excited about the 30s, man. I'm excited about getting older. Getting older is fun. I like it. There will be a point, I'm sure, where I'm like, oh, fuck, slow down. I don't actually want to be any older. Like, the prime years are like 30, like 29, 28. I enjoyed it very much. Like, the pandemic, fuck. You know what we need to get? This is something I thought about. When I get God on the horn later on the podcast, I want to, like, I think I can talk him into a mulligan year where
friend
just
of the pod.
Yeah, friend of the pod, God. we should all get an extra year, right? Like, this full year that we just had blown for no reason. Like, just, it's all gone. Just a full year. Gone.
Yeah, we'll have to talk to him. We'll see if we can get him on the pod and we can discuss some things.
Because, I don't know. I feel like if you're 62 and 63 during this time period, it's like, ah, who cares? Didn't really notice the difference. My life, mostly unchanged. 29 to 30, like, that's it's a big year to just throw a mulligan in, the prime years.
It's true. According to you, I lost one of my prime years, apparently, right at 30. I lost it. So I don't know what that means for me now at 31.
Yeah.
You know,
was there another pandemic in 2009?
It's all in the rear view at this point. I don't know.
I don't recall a pandemic taking place in 2009.
Why are you taking shots? these age, you're like 1.5 years younger than me. Like,
so many days. That is so many days younger than you. It's unreal how many days. You can't even calculate how many.
Oh, shoot. I guess you're like a full 2 years. You're like a full 2 years younger than me.
Yeah, exactly. You can tell the youth of mine.
I'm terrible at math. No, you're like a year. I'm like a year and 2 months older than you. Get out of here.
I think my youthfulness was part of what made me more endearing at North Georgia than yourself. Like, you just kind of had this old
head
attitude.
That's why so many people like you so much.
Shout out to Swagman89, who, big fan of the pod. I'm going to read this on the podcast. Did you see this?
No.
Okay. Got some new reviews. We're up to like 468 ratings. 5-star. We have a 5-star average.
Swagman89 is a strong name.
It is.
That's all I'm going to say to start things off.
I like it. Swagman89. The topic header, Bill Simmons knockoff, 1-star. I like it. Good start. And then the body. Chase tries way too hard to be Bill Simmons. Talks too much on his own show, as opposed to actually seeming interested in his guest perspectives. Enforces bad hot takes.
Oh, man. Really
fiery.
Digging deep on you.
Yeah. Really going after me.
Hey, you know, thanks for listening. You know, that's all you can say to those people.
Hi, Swagman89. Still going to keep doing the show, but thank you. Thank you for the kind words, as always. Happy listening. We're going to argue, and I'm going to... Hold on, let me pull up. What did he say? I'm going to not seem interested in what you're saying tonight, Matt. I'm going to force some bad hot takes, perhaps, on ESPN's FPI, because we're going to focus, because it's the offseason, on a different thing every week. What I want to focus on this week, Matt, the College Football Power Index got released, and no surprise, Alabama coming in at number one, projected to get 11 wins. They have a 76% chance of making the playoff, 51% chance of winning the conference, 50% chance of making the national title, and a 30% chance of winning the national title. What blew my mind, or like the fact that, okay, I don't know if you remember this or not, Matt Green, but you were very anti-Matt Campbell on this podcast. Do you recall? A few weeks back when we were doing the coaches rankings and you were like, oh, it's Iowa State. I mean, yeah, he's fine. But like
I gave him his due. He's top 10 coach in college football.
Yeah, he was low on your list. He's a little too low. He's in my top five. He's a top five coach.
We can keep going. We'll get to Matt Campbell.
He's number four. The Iowa State Cyclones coming in with a 40% chance of making the playoff this year, a 20% chance of making the national title game. 1-5. 1-5. Iowa State. For reference, your Georgia Bulldogs have a 6.5% chance and a 2.2 chance of winning the national title per FPI. And you're over here, Kirby, ahead of Matt Campbell. What are we doing?
Well, first of all, the reason the percentages are where they are is because for Georgia to get out of the SEC, they'll have
Oklahoma's right there for Iowa State.
That's true, but it's Oklahoma.
They're number two.
It's not Alabama.
Oklahoma and Alabama are almost neck and neck in FPI. That's what we're doing here. FPI number one.
In FPI, that's about the only place they're neck and neck. We saw
Spencer Rattler is the favorite to win the Heisman.
What'd you say?
Spencer Rattler is the favorite.
Oh, Spencer Rattler, Oklahoma's going to be good this year. I mean, you look at their schedule. I mean, they're obviously number two in the FPI. I mean, like, I can tell you what Oklahoma's going to do right now. Like, they don't play anybody. It's cool to see them playing the Nebraska game. Like, that's a rivalry I'm down to reignite. But, like, they're going to sleep through their first 10 games, and they got Iowa State and Oklahoma State right there at the end. Like, I almost guarantee you Oklahoma's going to lose to someone they shouldn't lose to, and then be one loss and be in the playoff by the end of the year. Like, that's essentially what Lincoln Riley does every year. Like, three of the 4 years he's been there, they've lost to a team that's finished unranked. So Oklahoma, yeah, they should walk right to the college football playoff as far as I'm concerned. I just don't understand this obsession with Iowa State. Like, it's like Matt Campbell is a great coach. But like, let's not pretend Iowa State is something they're not. Like, imagine, like, you brought up Georgia and Kirby. Like, how would we be talking about Georgia and Kirby Smart if they lost to University of Louisiana, Oklahoma State, and Oklahoma in the same year? Like, okay, it's, you know, you lost to the two best teams you played. Granted, they did beat Oklahoma the first time they played them, but you lost to the two best teams you played, and then you lost, and then you got beat pretty handedly by a Sun Belt conference team.
Well, hold on. You almost lost to Cincinnati in the bowl game, sir.
Cincinnati was undefeated. What are you talking about?
Hey, Louisiana, Cincinnati, one and the same, sir.
Louisiana was a solid team last year in terms of like a Sun Belt conference, for sure. But I'm saying, like, let's not get it twisted. Like, Matt Campbell's doing a great job to have Iowa State relevant and like in the top 10. But like, why are we not coming at Iowa State's schedule with the same energy we come at someone like Georgia? Like, Georgia lost by like, what was it, 16-17 to Florida and Alabama. Those are the only two teams they lost to. Alabama blew out everyone they played and won the national championship. Like, Iowa State's over here, like, losing to Sun Belt conference teams. Like, you know, Matt Campbell is obviously
a great team's
coach.
Plural. Like, and also it was the first game post pandemic.
Losing to one Sun Belt team is too many.
But calling them a Sun Belt team is a little disrespectful. Louisiana's good. And
they're in the Sun Belt. The Sun Belt's a conference that's improved, but it's still not a Power Five conference. Like, it's just weird that like we're kind of just focusing on like, oh, they have all these returning starters and oh, Matt Campbell's a genius and all this, but like we're not gonna look at the fact that they lost three games, like, to essentially the three best teams, two of the three best teams they played the entire season. Like, it's strange that we're not dissecting Iowa State's losses the way we dissect it with someone like Georgia. Like, it's just interesting to me, like, people's obsession with Matt Campbell and Iowa State. Like, I almost guarantee they're not going to be in the national championship, like, or in the playoff. Like, it's Iowa State. Like, I'm sorry. Like, you gotta. Wow. I'm not trying to be the old get off my lawn or anything. Like,
sounds
different teams
get off
that
my
aren't
lawn
into
me.
Traditional powers can't be good. Like, obviously Iowa State, I expect them to be a pretty solid team this
solid.
Year.
Solid. They're a solid national title contender.
I mean, so if they, I when I say solid, I feel like they're probably gonna go 9-3.
9-3 is a disaster for this group this year.
I feel like Iowa State going 9-3 and 10-2, like that's as good as they can ever expect to do. Like, it's just.
But also, just, think about what you're saying. Iowa State and this program and where they're having to recruit from, the players they're getting. And then you compare it to Georgia. I'm like, yeah, Georgia should be demanding 11 wins minimum every year. Like, the fan base should demand.
We can't talk out of both sides of our mouth here, though. It's like Iowa State is. Are they legit or are they just, oh, well, they're just kind of a good story?
No, you know what legit. I mean? It's.
If they're legit, then it's like, let's not talk about their recruiting base and where they're getting their talent from. Like, it's impressive what Matt Campbell has done with Iowa State, but I'm not ready to, like, to give them a higher FPI than Ohio State.
Well, Ohio State's going to be down. We don't know. Like, it's just, I think it's part of it's the returning stuff. I think part of it is there's a lot of turnover at Ohio State. Like, we don't even know who's going to be a quarterback for Ohio State yet.
That's true, but I feel like Ohio State seems like Oklahoma at this point. It's like it doesn't really matter what
they're not going to say they're going to drop up to like 9-3, 8-4, but it's just like it's more of like, hey, they should be the favorite in the Big Ten again, but you know,
I feel we're going to go through offseason where people kind of convince us that these other teams in the Big Ten are, you know, watch out for Penn State, watch out for Michigan or something, yeah. Kind of. Like, they're going to suggest that they can play with Ohio State. But as soon as football starts and we see the teams on the field, like, Ohio State's going to run through this conference like they do basically every year. Like, I don't know.
Get off my lawn, Matt Green, tonight.
I'm not buying anyone from, like,
why
really
even play the games with Matt Green? He's like, Oklahoma, Ohio State, Alabama, Georgia, Final Four, let's go. Skip the regular season. Let's do this.
I guess I'm jaded as like a college football like just fan, because it's not what I want to happen. I want teams to mix it up, but I just look like at the parity in the Iowa Big State Ten or lack thereof, and it's like is Indiana really going to knock off Ohio State, like Penn State?
Ohio State a lot of trouble last year.
They did, and I just. You know, Justin Fields is gone. It could be a completely different team, but I just look, none of these Ohio State quarterbacks have been good in the NFL. Not that I'm like starting that narrative or anything, but like none of these were essentially like just superstar quarterbacks, and all of them essentially put up the same numbers. Like, Ohio State fans talk like JT Barrett isn't good at all, and he basically just owns every Big Ten record. Like, every Dwayne Haskins, like every quarterback they get just kind of does the same thing, and they're going to be productive. Like, I don't, if it's CJ Stroud or I don't know who the other, the true freshman they got coming in, but it's like, I don't know who it's going to be, but I guarantee by the end of the year, he's probably got like 30 touchdowns, like 5 picks and, you know, double digit rushing touchdowns. And like, they're going to be, you know, the best team in the Big Ten by the end of it. Like, they might not make the playoff, you know, maybe they stumble and lose to Oregon, or, you know, maybe they drop one conference game. But this is how I always feel about the Big 12. It's like Iowa State can beat Oklahoma. You know, Texas can beat Oklahoma. But by the end of the year, they got to play in the Big 12 championship. They never seem to have a shot. Like, Oklahoma just always takes care of business. And that's how I feel about Ohio State. I just feel like I would like for Oregon to come into the horseshoe and knock them off. You know, change things up. Give us some different teams in the playoff. But I'm afraid Ohio State's just gonna run through this conference. I'm not as sold on them being in the playoff, like, just, you know, as I am Oklahoma and Clemson and probably Alabama.
Well, also, what is the schedule for Ohio State? They open at Minnesota and then get Oregon at home right after that, and then Tulsa, a good Tulsa team. What is the schedule?
That is an interesting start to the season. I mean, do we expect Minnesota to be better this year?
Yes.
Like, they were a huge disappointment last year.
Yeah, I think they'll be better. Tanner Morgan's back. It was a weird year for them. I'm not ready to count out PJ Fleck and that group. They've recruited well, and I think they'll bounce back. I don't think they'll beat Ohio State, but that's a brutal way to start off a new group. And then you look at Iowa State. I was looking at Oklahoma and Iowa State's schedule too as you're talking. Iowa State. You and I, Iowa at home is going to be a bloodbath, because Iowa, sneaky good. They're a really good program right now. I think that game is just going to be must see. I'm excited. Game day better be in Ames for that game on September 11th. But yeah, you got that. And then you got at UNLV, at Baylor, Kansas at home, at K-State. So you're looking at like late October before games get really interesting for Iowa State. But like, what did they like? I just going into Oklahoma on the 20th. They get Texas at home. They get West Virginia on the road. And they get Oklahoma State at home. Oklahoma State also, we haven't mentioned where they are in this FPI index. They are number, let's see here,
nine,
yeah. So they're right below Mississippi State, and Georgia and Mississippi State being right there next to each other, it warms my heart, because Mississippi State gave your Bulldogs all they could handle with Will Rogers last year. Gave them all you can handle.
I mean, they did, but yeah.
I've always called Georgia the Mississippi State Bulldogs of the East. You know that.
I'm not sure what that means. Mississippi State's won the division like once ever, but
well, they have. Here's what I mean by that: they have the same amount of national titles in my lifetime.
I mean, that's a just taking jabs. what's going on with you today? You just taking shots all day. Look, Georgia. I was surprised to see Georgia at seven, because I feel like for these of all these teams that are ranked above them, like Georgia, Iowa State and Oklahoma are the only ones that return their starting quarterback. Mm. And you look at Georgia's schedule, like the East, like I think a lot of people expect Florida to take a step back next year. You know, the FBI's got them at 14, which is like, that's pretty low for someone like of Florida's brand. You know, that's kind of like a solid step back. So I feel like Florida seems like clearly the second best team in the East, other than maybe Missouri. So outside of, you know, in Auburn, you always have Auburn and as the lock from the West, but
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Everyone's experienced the pain of dropped calls and internet outages, especially working remotely this last year. So here's the question. If you're the telco company, how do you help create better experiences for customers? Simple. ServiceNow digital workflows can help solve network problems faster and provide real-time status updates so customers aren't left in the dark. That's probably why ServiceNow workflows have helped telco companies see an increase in customer satisfaction. But proactive customer communication's only half the battle. With a single view of your back, middle, and front office operations, ServiceNow workflows also eliminate silos, keeping teams more in sync and more productive. With our scalable services, companies assure a better experience for both customers and employees on a single platform, the Now Platform. So how do you help provide a better network experience for customers? With ServiceNow for telecommunications to help streamline network operations. Whatever your business is facing, let's workflow it. ServiceNow.
Other than that Clemson game, there's just not many teams that should be able to beat Georgia on their schedule. So that's why Georgia seemed weird at seven, because this Alabama, like Alabama, you know, you just kind of expect to be, you know, they are what they are at this point. They just reload and they're dominant. But this seems like more question marks than Alabama's had in recent years, with just losing the quarterback, losing the running back, losing the wide receivers.
Men that are coming through. Did you see the five-star linemen, the brothers?
Oh, yeah. It's absurd the way Alabama recruits. They're a factory, but there is more question marks around them than there has been in recent years. So I would give Georgia a better shot to win the SEC than they're giving them. Like you said, what, like a 30% shot to win the SEC?
Yeah.
I feel like it's essentially like a 50% shot. Like there's no one else that's coming out of the East other than Georgia. Like
Shots fired at Mizzou.
I just don't see it happening personally. So and I just think they're more proven. Like Texas A&M at six, I think we kind of jumped over them. Like that was strange to me. Like we, you know, losing Kellen Mond, and it's just tough to expect no drop off after having a 4-year starter at quarterback. Like, you know, Texas A&M, they have to go through the SEC West, and I don't know how you could possibly say A&M has, like, just in terms of a mathematical, like, better chance to make the playoff than Georgia would. Unless you're saying, like, we haven't seen a team lose the SEC championship and get in, so maybe you're saying as that team that doesn't play in the SEC championship, that's just a one-loss team, kind of how Alabama got in a few years ago, and when they got into the national championship without winning the conference. I guess that could give A&M a better shot, but I would say Georgia seems to have more proven, like, kind of returning starters, a more stability than I would say Texas A&M has. And then I just don't understand at all how Mississippi State is up here.
I was looking, so their schedule is actually not even great. Like, I was looking at it because, like, that's the other weird part about the FPI with, like, them and where they're at right now is that I'm looking at it and because I think, let me pull up their projected wins. Yeah, their projected wins 8.2, like 8-4. Like, I look at this and I'm like, the schedule's tough. Like, Mississippi State has a tough schedule. They get Louisiana Tech first and Starkville. They get NC State, who's good. They get a good NC State.
That's one of the more quality games at a conference I've ever seen Mississippi State schedule, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, they got a really good quarterback now at NC State and that with Mr. Leary. And then you got at Memphis. Memphis is always going to be good. Like, that's going to be a high-scoring fair. Then they get LSU and Texas A&M back-to-back, and then Alabama. They have a three-game stretch of those three.
Welcome to the SEC West, man. I feel like that's what happens every year. You know what I mean? That's why I don't understand.
Well, they also are on the road at Arkansas and at Auburn.
Yeah, I just going 4-7 in Mike Leach's first year, like I was like, maybe there's something to like year two of Mike Leach. And it's like at Texas Tech, he went from 7-6 first year to 7-5. Washington State went from 3-9 first year to 6-7. And then 3-9 again year three. Like, his year three in Texas Tech was a 9-5 season, like got into the top 25. But like, I'm not really sure what people are basing this on. Like, Will Rogers looked solid when he played. You know, he looked solid against Georgia, that's for sure. Threw the ball about 60 times. But it's like, I don't see them, you know, coming out of the SEC with even a winning conference record. Like, maybe I'm missing something on Mississippi State, but like, with like you said, A&M, I think LSU will be improved. You know, maybe people are expecting Auburn to kind of struggle in year one of Brian Harsin, but you know, Auburn wasn't that bad. Like, Auburn's not some rebuilding job. Like, Auburn, they get the right guy in there, they could be good this year or next year. You know, like, if someone can improve Bo Nix, I feel like Bo Nix has the tools like to be a good quarterback in college at least. So I was hoping you could shed some light on why Mississippi State is at number 8, because I, for the life of me, cannot. And even going at Memphis, like that could be a dangerous game as far as I'm concerned for Mississippi State.
I guess they're just betting on this offense just being otherworldly. Will Rogers did show a lot at the end of last year, and I'm a Will Rogers guy. I think he's going to be really good in this conference. And they found their guy, and they found their next Gardner Minshew. And maybe that's all it is. It's just they're going to be a pain in the ass to slow down on Saturdays, like with the full season of installs for Leach's offense at Mississippi State, that they're just going to be a pain in the ass for all these teams. But I don't know. I thought everything you need to know about the ACC is in this too, by the way. Clemson, who we think is going to have kind of a down year, they're in down in terms of like, we'll see what DJ Uiagalelei looks like. But by all accounts, losing ETN, losing a lot of guys.
So you, Lawrence. I see. You expect Clemson to take a step back? I don't expect.
I don't think
Clemson.
They're gonna. I would not put them in like a favorite category to win the national title. Like, I would be very, very surprised if they won the Natty next year. I would say, but they have a 72% chance of winning the ACC, the highest of any team.
Yeah, it's just because like you have that game versus Georgia to open up, and then It's like who's beating Clemson? Like, you know, go at NC State week 4, like. North Carolina's not on the schedule. Like, you know,
do they really not have North
Louisville?
Carolina on it?
No, they don't have North Carolina on it. So they're like, they'll most likely play North Carolina, I think most people think, in the ACC championship. That'd be a solid opponent. But, you know, at Louisville, first week of November, like, you know, maybe that's a tough game, but, you know, maybe Florida State's improved, but I don't know. I think it's going to be like, I think if Clemson loses to Georgia in the opener, and then Georgia, like if Georgia's the SEC champion or something, or at least is playing in the SEC championship game, and that's your only loss, like you run the table, go 11-1 and or then 12-1 after winning the ACC championship. I almost feel like it's a predetermined result almost. Like it seems like Clemson's gonna just walk through this conference. Cause I mean, that cornerback that got kicked off, right? That's the only starter that is not returning for Clemson next year. So they're loaded on defense. And then, like you said, DJ Uiagalelei, if I'm pronouncing that right, I mean, he's going to be a solid quarterback. He's not going to be bad in this offense. So I think they have plenty of playmakers. I think they'll be right back in the playoff again.
I think they'll be in the playoff again. I just don't think they're a team that's going to make it through the gauntlet and everything else. But we'll see. We'll see what the offseason plays out. Who do you see on this list that's way too low that you're like, oh, this rank, I'm buying stock. Give me two because I have two for you.
You go first.
USC is way too low on this. USC is behind Indiana, West Virginia, Texas Tech, which is just preposterous at how high Texas Tech is in this list. I think USC with Keaton Slovis in this group is going to be really good. I think they should be considered the favorites to win the Pac-12, and I think they're my if I had to guess, if there's a Pac-12 team that makes the playoff, it's USC.
Where do they have USC?
They have them way down, like 20. I guess
they're not top 25, huh?
Yeah, they're 26.
Oh, okay.
Way too low on USC.
You said USC, and who's the other one?
The other one is where'd it go? Hold on. LSU.
Okay.
18's too low for LSU. They're getting a lot of talent back. I love the offseason additions on offense. I think this is a do or die year. I like Max Johnson a lot, and it seems like he's the leader in the clubhouse there, the lefty. He looked good down the stretch. I think LSU will be back. I think they'll be like what people are expecting, like where Texas A&M is on this list right now. That's where I put LSU.
Oh, see, I don't know if I would put them that high. I think personally, just with proven talent, I think Georgia's a little low, but like seven compared to like what, maybe three or four, like it's not that big of a difference. But I honestly, like, if I was gonna say a random out of the left field team was from the SEC West was gonna be in the top 10, I would have said Ole Miss instead of Mississippi State. Like Ole Miss down at 22 and Mississippi State at 8, like I wouldn't have either of them that high, but if you were gonna tell me one of them was gonna be that high, I definitely would have thought Ole Miss. Like they at least seem like the sexier pick. Like I can't get past the Mississippi State stuff. Like I'm just
you're really
confused.
Upset about it.
I'm just confused. So who's making this list? Where's the rationale? But yeah, Ole Miss seems like that team that just is dangerous, that could beat anybody, but you also feel like they could lose to anybody. So it's tough to really know where to rank them. LSU, I definitely would agree with you, seems like that team that's being undervalued right now because of one bad season. But also, I don't know if I necessarily think they should be higher, but I expected them to be higher, and that was North Carolina. Like at 13, I was kind of expecting the Iowa State, maybe even Oklahoma State hype to be on North Carolina. Like this,
well, we should also mention
like
Oklahoma
dark
State
horse.
Too. They fit in my like. I was confused. We haven't really touched on them, but that's way too high because we haven't even seen one good season of Spencer Sanders yet. Like, can we get one before we crown Oklahoma State? Can we get one?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, Mike Gundy, he's got a history of at least putting together like competitive teams, like flirting with those top 10 rankings and stuff. But North Carolina seems like they have a lot of those pieces that people point to of like, you know, this is going to make them a factor next year. And I think having, in my opinion, the best quarterback in college football, Sam Howell, I think that I would have North Carolina in my top 10. I would have them. I would definitely have him ahead of Iowa State, personally.
Yeah. Well, that's all I've got on the FPI. Do you want to quickly talk about the recruiting calendar resuming back on June 1st and the NCAA panel formally approving a new transfer rule?
Yeah, I mean, those are both huge, huge news for the people who don't know out there. They've approved at the end of the dead period for the recruiting dead period, which is recruits can come on campus and make official visits and everything. June 1st is when that's being lifted, and you're already seeing teams line up visits for that first weekend of June. And I feel like that's just a return to some normalcy, right? Like seeing recruits on campus, throwing up the gloves and putting on the uniforms and everything on official visits, like, that's what we need. Need to get back to normal. And then, yeah, I think it was already, I think pretty much everyone knew that it was going to be approved, but now having the one-time transfer the one-time transfer rule for any student athlete without sitting out is now passed. And that's definitely a good rule. It was only a matter of time. Like, just the hypocrisy of the NCAA was kind of just showing that, like, these coaches can go wherever they want, but the 18 to 22 year olds that have a limited amount of time to play, they are the ones that have to sit out. After a while, it didn't make any sense. Guys transfer for so many different reasons, and it's just so arbitrary how some of them would be eligible with completely illegitimate reasons or seeming illegitimate, and then guys that did have illegitimate reasons would then be forced to sit out. So it's nice to just take it off the table. None of these, I mean, I don't know, I guess the conference stuff is still, that's still in limbo of, you know, interconference transfers being approved. But I mean, that's only a matter of time too, because at the end of the day, these guys aren't paid. You know, it's like, you shouldn't be able to prevent a college student from going to another college and trying to find the best opportunity for himself, you know?
Yeah. I'm excited to see what this all means. I think the one-time transfer rule, people were freaking out about it, but it'll probably be weird for a year or two, but it'll settle. A lot of players will figure out that the grass is not as greener, and that it's gonna settle, because there's gonna be the good stories of the guys who find the right situation and then flip it into a great thing that gives them a professional career. There are gonna be other ones who go to an even worse situation and then are kind of screwed. I don't know.
I think you're 100% right. I think for maybe a year, two, maybe three, it's going to be the wild, wild west. But then you're going to see, you know, these teams, they're a business, you know, and you're going to see the harsh reality of the business. And you had a scholarship at this school and you wanted to leave, and now those scholarship opportunities aren't there like you thought they would be. And, you know, there's going to be plenty of cautionary tales of guys transferring from D1 schools and not having any other D1 schools that want to take them. So you're definitely going to see just some craziness, I think, for a couple years. But yeah, it'll, I think, work itself out, just because it is a two-way street. It's like, if these players can leave, it's like these schools can also be trying to get other players. So these guys, I think, kind of be careful what you wish for, kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, Matt Green, shorter show tonight. Traveling this weekend and got some other stuff to cook in tonight. But thank you, as always, my good friend. And we'll be back to normal next week. Thank you, my good friend. And stay safe down there in Dacula, Georgia.
And yes, I'll sir. You safe. You hold it down for that dirty 30
okay.
birthday, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Asheville, I'm excited. I'm excited. You only turn 30 once, is what they say. Matt Green.
Oh, so you're going to Asheville. So you're some hippie, huh? Is that what's going on?
Yes.
No. You know me. What are you going up there for? Like breweries and stuff? You big brewery guy?
I'm a big just scenery guy. Love getting away. Love the mountains.
You love seeing the mountains. I'm a big mountain guy.
Yeah. I'm more of a mountain guy than a beach guy. So it's just always been, I like getting away, where the air is crisp, where the water flows like, what was the Dumb and Dumber line? Something Capistrano. What was that line?
I would have thought any Dumb and Dumber line you would have asked me, I would have been able to come up with, but I wasn't prepared for that one.
The wine flows like something out of Capistrano. Like what? Oh, this is gonna drive me nuts. Damn. Now I gotta watch Dumb and Dumber tonight to remember this. Either way, for that guy down there in Dacula, Georgia, Matt Green, for myself up here in Knoxville, Tennessee, that is all I've got. Stay tuned for the other two parts in this very episode. But Matt, thank you as always, my friend.
Have a good one.
All right. Hello and welcome back to a Thursday edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. I'm now joined by old friend William R. Washington of RBR Wrestling, a very good wrestling podcast that you could listen to every single Wednesday night by going to fanoff.com and go check it out. It's a great, great show that I've been listening to for over a decade. I've done the math because I turned 30, Will, on Sunday, and
dang.
I know for sure I was listening to RBR in college. So that is where we're at.
Yeah, I bumped into a listener. I was at Daly's place on Friday, and he was telling me how he's been listening for about 12 years. And then I thought, well, I mean, I've been hosting it for 16. So no matter what, I can always top everybody's number. So, yeah. And we're approaching, I'll be 34 this year. So I'll be approaching the point where RBR has consumed half of my life.
Mm. How do you feel about that?
Interestingly, I have some thoughts about it that I'm not ready to share yet, but
oh no.
Yeah.
Good thoughts or bad thoughts?
Thoughts.
Oh no.
So that's about it.
Oh no. Is it coming this year? 2021?
So 2021 is when I turn 34, yeah. And so next year, so I did some math and I calculated things, mm-hmm. and it's
gonna
right,
be folks.
Interesting.
I will be taking over as the lead host of RBR Weekly Wrestling Talk. You heard it here first.
Yep.
That's the news. No, it's actually Cody or Scats, and then that's it for the show.
And Scats is an original, so he'd be coming back.
Yeah. Mac Galloway. That's what it is. Or that guy who's there for a cup of coffee. Not Michael Z.
Bill Sullinger.
Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm. how was Daly's Place? So you went, how was the experience?
Daly's Place is an incredible venue. I had kind of a crummy night and I told the story on RBR, but beyond that, I went to Tampa. I went to Florida for WrestleMania weekend and I flew into Tampa, but then I happened upon a really good seat for The House Always Wins, the AEW house show, which had I think it was the biggest crowd they've done in the pandemic. And so I thought, okay, I gotta go. And so I drove, I think it was like 3.5 hours, which goes by when you've got podcasts to listen to. But I drove the 3.5 hours to Jacksonville from Tampa, and yeah, Daly's Place. It's a great venue. Like TV doesn't illustrate. And I get what the wrestlers were saying now. Cause Kenny Omega has talked about how it's an outdoor venue, but it doesn't look like it on television. But it truly is an outdoor venue that just happens to have like a roof, but the sides aren't covered. So you're still feeling like you're outdoors. Like you still get wind. You still get all of that. You just won't get rained on. They talked about how what makes Daly's Place different for wrestlers is the weather conditions that in the summertime, they're wrestling outside in 100 degree weather and trying to wrestle 20-minute matches and getting completely gassed or having to have heaters on in the wintertime. But like as a venue, it's just really cool. And it's like fully outdoors. And like the social distancing thing is like, you're in your own pod. But there's still a lot of people. It still gets really loud. I almost feel like TV isn't doing it justice of how loud the fans are. Like I felt like I was just at a normal wrestling event. But then it's an amphitheater setup, so everybody kind of has the same view. And I until being there, I was like, this is really conducive to pro wrestling. Like, the thing about pro wrestling is there's always the fan side and the hard camera side. And as a wrestler, you're either playing to the hard camera or you're playing to the fans, but never necessarily both. And then in Daly's Place, you kind of have the setup where the fans are on the same side as the hard camera. So as wrestlers are like playing to the hard camera, they're also just playing to the fans in the building. And I feel like that's a really easy way to generate a reaction. And so it's kind of cool. I was actually really happy being there. And it was just a cool, loud environment. And also it was nice to see that, I thought for a long time that, what do we need house shows for? Like, what do wrestlers need house shows for? And I forgot that part of the charm of house shows is to not have the constraints of television, that you can just do fun stuff. You can just, you can play with the fans. You hear a reaction from a fan. The little things like, a fan once at a house show I was at when Sean Spears was locked in a submission and mid-submission, somebody yells, "You're not a 10, Sean Spears, you're not a 10. And he just responds back while in the submission. He's like, "Your mom was a 10. and it's like little things that you really couldn't do like on television, or like you can't just like stop mid-match to like grab the mic and just like berate the fans to like turn up the heat. There's little things you just can't do, but they're able to do. And I recognize that the house show experience is something that the wrestlers are going to need back just to not have to continually work in 6-minute constraints. Like, just do what you want.
Well, they made up some event this past week when I was watching Dynamite early this morning. Something in, not in your house. What was it that they showed? Was this what you were at?
Yeah, it was the house always wins.
Yeah, okay. So that was made up. I don't recall that ever being a thing. And I saw that and I was like, what is this? Is this another AEW Dark Elevation? What am I looking at here?
That was the house show. But yeah, okay. So Tony Khan had said for a while that, you know, they weren't going to put that show out. He was like, you know, the advertisements were, you have to see this. You have to be there to see this because this will not be on television. And that was actually kind of part of the appeal for me in that we were talking about.
Oh, so you went reckless and you were berating the wrestlers. You were like, I get carte blanche. It's not going to be on TV.
Even worse. So you and I were talking about before we started recording that, you know, I've always been known for my wrestling memory and that I watch. I can't give up
making
watching
your children cry for the clicks.
But I can't give up watching because, like, I hate having those gaps in my wrestling knowledge. Mm. And it was one of those things where I've seen every AEW show, whether it's Dark, Elevation, Dynamite, the pay-per-views, all of it. And I've got it all fairly well memorized.
You're not watching all of Dark every week.
Yep.
Are you really?
I keep it on in the background. It's not like I'm like attentively paying attention, but like I work from home, so what am I going to do? So I just throw it on, and I throw it on Wednesday mornings, and I have it on. So at least I've been aware of all the results. But it was like, oh no, a show's going to happen and create a gap in my AEW memory because I won't have seen a show. It's so. I wasn't going to go out of my way to go until I was like, well, you know, tickets were cheap. It was like $30 for like a really good seat. I think I was in the front row of section 2 and I was like, I could do this and I'm going to do it. And so I did. And, it was the thing is though, they did have the cameras taping. They had the whole crew there. Tony Schiavone and the first half of it and Tony Schiavone and Colt Cabana and Ricky Starks were on commentary for the second half. So like at some point they're going to put that out. There's no reason to record commentary for something that you're not putting out. And like they were filming it. I have a feeling it's going to be put out eventually.
Interesting. WrestleMania also happened this weekend. Well,
yes, it did.
I hated it. Hated it because it was two nights.
Oh,
no, okay. I didn't mean the actual matches and everything. I just, I'm a busy guy, Will, in grad school. Work a normal job, do a lot on this podcast. I have a lot to watch. And then when I remembered that it was two nights of WrestleMania, along with everything that was moving on this week and all the new time slots for different shows, I was like, dear God, I have so much to watch. And I just like, I can feel the knots just popping out in the back of my shoulders because I'm like, this is so much content I have to watch. So I watched it and it was all great. Like, I think this was one of my more enjoyable WrestleManias. And I also just like it being two nights anyway. I think this should be actually a full-time thing, doing two-night WrestleManias. I was more annoyed about the takeovers and everything because that like added to the week and just, it was a lot of stuff. And it's content wars and I don't like it because I don't have time. But I did think this was a good show. I was happy to see Guy Who Stinks, also known as Drew McIntyre, lose clean Bobby Lashley. I was a very big fan of this.
Problem was I was okay with it. I thought that I would have preferred Bobby win a little cleaner because as it stood, Drew just looked like an idiot. He had it won until MVP was like, hey, and he's like, oh, let me stop my finisher that I've beaten everybody from Brock Lesnar to Randy Orton to you name it, I've beaten him with. But somebody at ringside just yells, hey, and I'm going to stop in the middle of my finish, which allows me to get distracted by Bobby Lashley, who beat me. And I just thought, you just made Drew look dumb more so than look.
That's good.
No, I would have rather Bobby just looked stronger in this night, not smarter, because like that's not who Bobby is. Bobby is just somebody who will beat you. He's not necessarily somebody who needs to beat you viscerally.
Well, that might have been more MVP being smarter there.
Yeah, but also, what did MVP really do besides just yell hey? Like, he didn't even grab his foot or anything.
That's why I was clean.
Yeah, it was clean because it was more so Drew getting distracted. I will say this. I think everybody who looked at the WrestleMania card said on paper, they're like, oh, night two is going to be the much better night. And I think by nearly every measure, it was not.
Yeah, didn't have Bad Bunny on it, which was a problem.
No, it didn't. I feel like every night one match, other than maybe the world titles, was better than its night two counterpart. Like the women's title was better in night one. I don't know. I enjoyed night one a whole lot more. It was just a better experience.
Also the better, I enjoyed both main events, but I think night one had the better main event and also had the better memorable moment of the whip. Like that's just going to be an all time.
Yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
Great moment.
I also don't know that, Roman retaining was all that wise. And that's not to say that,
that man is not losing and eating a pin for years. Like,
I know. I guess the issue is that this is your first night with fans and probably probably the night that you should have sent the fans home a little happier. And
I think fans like Roman.
No, he got booed.
Yeah, like, they like him. That's good. It used to be like just, go away. No, it's like he's getting booed.
Well, yeah, but what I mean is the happy ending. I feel like WrestleMania has definitely been kind of the king of those moments of the Daniel Bryan type ending for WrestleMania 30. I'm not saying Bryan should have won, but just that type of ending, or you know, WrestleMania 14 with Stone Cold, or just anything along those lines. With WWE, the WrestleMania 12, Shawn Michaels, like there's always been the that big moment, that big crowning moment that WrestleMania is really good at. And I feel like with your first night in front of fans, you probably should have done that. And especially when you had a really easy story to tell with Edge, which is the easiest story to tell in professional wrestling. For whatever reason, WWE just chooses not to. Almost every time that story's been handed to him, and the story I'm referring to is wrestler gets injured while champion and has to relinquish title. Wrestler returns to challenge for title they never lost and wins it in a moment of triumph.
Karrion Kross did that last week.
I mean, nobody watches NXT. Like, I'm talking about, like, in the on main scale WWE. Like, you know, that was an easy, like, it was a layup with Balor where he won the Universal title and had to relinquish it the next night. And so it's like, okay, you bring him back immediately to challenge for the title. That is a layup, and they didn't do it. He didn't even get his first shot for another like year and a half after that. And same with like Daniel Bryan, who had to relinquish the title at WrestleMania in 2014, and he never lost it. So it was like, okay, again, layup. Daniel Bryan is the fan favorite. You bring him. He came back in 2015. He came back just before the Royal Rumble. It is the perfect opportunity to have him win the Rumble and go challenge for the title he never lost. And then you had Edge, who had the biggest version of that story, which is that he had to relinquish the title 10 years ago. 10 years ago! And came back, won the Rumble, and has the opportunity to challenge for the title he never lost. And for whatever reason, WWE is so against just, like, doing it. I feel like they've only really done it maybe twice. And like, I think about Batista was one of them, where like Batista, he didn't win it immediately when he had to relinquish the title in 2006. But he he lost his first challenge. And that was the story, was that he can't seem to get back to that level. And then he eventually did. He like had to challenge Booker T, I think like three or four times before finally he beat him and became world champion. And that was the story. But like,
but you got something better, and Roman pinned them both.
No, that sucks.
I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the visual of Roman pinning them both. I just love a good dominant heel. That actually, and I love this version of Roman Reigns. It's great.
Yeah, I like it too. I feel like, and I said this on RBR, but I think that historically, the things that are remembered most historically typically have to have some kind of historical moment. And the easiest historical moment is a title change, because then you literally made history. Literally, it's written in the history books that this moment changed the world title. So, but the problem is with an instance like this, where you had what I thought was a great main event of Edge, Daniel Bryan, and Roman Reigns, there's no historical moment attached to it. So it's just a match that exists. And I think historically this match won't be remembered as well as like Batista, Orton, and Bryan, because that match had that match made history. And
I don't know about that.
But this one didn't. This one didn't make any history. It's just another match that took place inside Roman's reign.
I like the pun. Bianca, though, she had a great moment, and that'll be remembered.
She made history.
She did. I thought night one, by and large, AJ Styles and Elmos is fun for me. In the New Day, that was fun. Cesaro and Rollins was what it needed to be. Natalya and Tamina was...
I don't know who that's for.
Maxwell.
Or who they're for. No, definitely not Maxwell. Like, I don't know who Natalya and Tamina as a team are for, or why.
People who are bad at their jobs that still want good opportunities. There's a lot of them out there.
It's one of those things where, like, you're bad at your job, but you've got tenure, and so therefore, you should. Because, like, I see
Union
that from a
lot of Bustin' Will joins the podcast.
I saw from a lot of people who were like, you know, Tamina finally deserves her due. She's been around since 2010, and I thought, but she hasn't done anything since 2010. Like, she just existed. Is that what we're doing now? Like, you just get your due for being there?
Yeah, I don't know. It is what it is. But I don't know. I think things are pretty solid. I mean, Raw was kind of boring. I sighed. I wrote down in my notes watching Raw early on Tuesday of just like the main event scene of like, oh, Raw is still Raw, because Randy Orton interrupts, Braun Strowman interrupts. The Fiend obviously still not completely done, and I don't know where that's going with the Alexa Bliss stuff. But like, you look at it, and Drew also there in your last shot, I'm like, oh god, this is not a main event scene anybody should want. This is not good. They need another shakeup already.
Yeah. I don't know who. Like, I feel like their goal is still Drew McIntyre, that at this point it was really just, yeah, I think that they just wanted Bobby to not have a short reign, because he didn't even get to retain it through a pay-per-view. Like, he won it, and then, he hasn't. This was his first pay-per-view title defense. So I think they just wanted him to have that, but ultimately I think they're still on the Drew McIntyre kick.
Interesting. I don't know. I don't know.
One might even say they're on a Claymore.
Okay. We won't. Will. AEW this week. Who are the winners for you this week, and who are the losers?
Biggest winner, Jade Cargill, who just continues to prove that she is something special, and it is amazing. Like, that was a diamond get for them, because. There's certain little character things that I feel still need some work with her, as far as like her speaking. But I feel like she'll get that. In the meantime, though, her look, she's like everything people pretended Charlotte was for a long time, where, like, you know, everybody had always said Charlotte is just like this natural athlete. And that's not to say that Charlotte's bad, because I think Charlotte's great. But
great,
like,
promo this week from her.
Yeah, very good. But like, when I see Jade Cargill, that's like everything that I've heard about Charlotte for the longest time, that she is like, she's just got the stature, she's got the build, she's got the muscles, but then she just seems to be naturally athletic in the ring. And she is so much better than anybody in their who's in their third televised match, I guess fourth if you're going to count the house show. But anybody who's having their fourth match, she's way better than anybody who should be at that point. And it's like, and then the presentation of her, they've done a great job with, where like her entrance has the, like, the dark lighting and
her entrance
the little circle.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. They've got the little circles on the ramp. I don't even know what that's supposed to be, but I love it. And the Tron with the storm brewing and the music and the pyro. And it's like, they are presenting her like a star. And then she comes out and she dominates. I feel like she definitely came out of this week's Dynamite, a winner.
I would agree. Who else did you have as a winner?
But also her opponent, Red Velvet. I feel like Red Velvet comes off so fiery, and there's just something about her that's clicking for me. And even in this match, like, she shouldn't have beaten Red Velvet, so like, there's no way I would have pushed for that. But I love how the story of the match was she's gonna give everything she's got at Red Velvet. Like, Red Velvet needs to be like female Brock Lesnar. She just needs to beat the shit out of people. But
did you say female Brock Lesnar for Red Velvet?
Not Red Velvet. I mean Jade Cargill.
Okay.
Jade Cargill.
I was like what?
No, Jade Cargill needs to be like female Brock Lesnar. She just needs to conquer people. But at the same time, Red Velvet can kind of in that same vein be one of like the smaller opponents that Brock has faced, where it's like, yeah. She's really trying and really can throw Jade as far off her game as she can get, but ultimately falls short, and and Jade continues to look dominant. But I think those two were winners. Also, just because he's a big name in Twitter discourse, literally as we speak, Anthony Ogogo kind of wins because there's a whole lot of debate over his finish, which was a gut punch. And not just a gut punch, but a gut punch followed by ref stoppage. There's so many people talking about this right now and whether or not that's a good finish. I think it's great. I think that, are you kidding me, being punched in the gut by an Olympic boxer? Like the idea, and it's not like he punched like John Moxley and he went down. Like he punched some jobber who, as I saw put on Twitter, like looks like he's on his way to a GCW show. Like this is not somebody who looks like they should hang anyway. But the idea of if you continue to put, it's like Paul Heyman booking 101, right? Paul Heyman had this idea that, or the notion that if you do a move enough times in front of crowds, eventually it just gets accepted as the norm. Like he had the idea that if I gave Mark Henry a headlock and you tapped out immediately and you did that for 32 straight weeks, eventually the crowds will see the headlock as the most devastating move in wrestling just because. you did it enough times and you had it be effective enough times. But then on the 33rd time, the moment that you have like a John Cena power out of it, it's like, oh my God, he just powered out of Mark Henry's headlock. How did he do that? When like at the end of the day, it was just a headlock. But it's the same thing with Anthony Ogogo to me. If you have enough people go down to that gut punch and then finally he has to face somebody like Cody, and it's been, you know, let's say it's been about a year of him beating people with this gut punch. And now all of a sudden, Cody has to survive a match with Anthony Ogogo. And the match is all about protecting his midsection because he knows if Anthony Ogogo lands that gut punch, it's over for him. Like there's a lot of stuff you can do with that. And I think it's great. I think that people are just kind of stuck in the mindset of, well, people get punched in the gut all the time. Yeah, but not everybody's an Olympic boxer. Like at some point, we have to accept that some people are better at things than others. And yeah, one day I just want them to keep doing it so much that somebody gets hit with it and just like vomits. I feel like that's like the best thing you could do with the gut punch as a finish. I don't know. What'd you think of it?
It's really hard to pull that off in professional wrestling. And I think it's really hard to retrain wrestling fans' brains on this. And I don't know. For me, it's not for me.
I think you can't retrain wrestling fan brains in the same way that you always have been able to, which is just like repetition. That's how you retrain wrestling brains fans. Wrestling brains fans.
Well,
wrestling
see, I
fans
take brain. Notes on all of these shows every week, and I just write down, doesn't look good. And I just feel like I'm going to do that every time. No, I'm just going to write, doesn't look right. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I guess. I just feel like you have enough. You beat enough people with it eventually. Because like I used to think Big Show's knockout punch was silly.
Oh, it's always silly. Did it yeah, enough. I think it's always looked silly.
Until he did it enough times. And then eventually I was like, no, actually, this is good. The only thing I hated about the knockout punch was Big Show's taller than everybody. So why didn't
go
he
way
just
down.
Like, no, it was just like, why didn't he just start every match with that? Why does this have to be a finish when, like, literally, it would be very difficult for anybody shorter than him to evade that? Like, just punch people and win.
Who were the losers this week for you? Ray Phoenix, obviously.
I don't know. It was pretty much like an all around decent show to me. I won't even say decent. I thought it was good because I didn't like last week's episode at all. And I think this was a step up. Like, one more winner. And that is the entire women's division. Because maybe it's not having NXT on against it, but they featured the women more than they have in any single episode of AEW. And everybody has a clear direction. You had, I mentioned Red Velvet and Jade Cargill, but then right after they showed the Britt Baker promo where she is trying to work the system of working up the rankings, and she's currently ranked number 3, but then she noted that Red Velvet was number 2 and just lost. So she's like, that should put me at number 2. And the number 1 contender faces Sheeta next week. So again, more direction, because we have the number 1 contender, Ty Conti, challenging Hikaru Shida, the AEW Women's World Champion. And so, like, there's things happening with them. And it's like they've been kind of focused on Ty Conti for weeks now. And they're doing something with her. And then there was also a promo from Thunder Rosa. And she made her intentions clear of where she's headed. But then you also had the return of Chris Statlander. And she beat Amber Nova, but it was like Chris Statlander looked good. And I mean, like, really looked good. Like, she trimmed down, and put on a bunch of muscle and just looked phenomenal. And it was like, dang, you really showcased the women this week in a way that you never have. And, I was very happy with that. I guess losers. I don't know. Matt Hardy, and also, I think I can see how the faction stuff is starting to become a bit much for people.
I'm very pro faction. I'm very pro faction.
I mean, like, I can only be so with it if there's an end game to it all. In that, like to me, it feels like they're building to some kind of like big faction show of like. But the only thing I could think of you would do that with is War Games or Blood and Guts. And like they have announced that for Pinnacle versus Jericho, versus the Inner Circle. So like, are they going to do more of them? Because like there are multiple situations now where there's a team of 5 that could face another team of 5. You know, like the Elite, now that they just brought in the Young Bucks, or brought the Young Bucks back into the fold. That's now a team of 5 who could easily face any other team of 5. Like, I don't know what's happening here. Like, there's a lot of like warring stuff. So I am curious where that's all going. But for the most part, I wasn't let down by the show. And I thought it was paced better than usual because it felt like they weren't trying to pace it for preventing channel changers. It seemed like it was just paced to exist. And that's how I've wanted Dynamite to be for a long time.
All right. Well, Will, what can we check out from you this week across RBR Wrestling and everywhere else?
Well, you know, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/RBR Wrestling. We did a lot of wrestling coverage, so this is going to be our break from pro wrestling this weekend. We're actually going to talk some movies, which that's just something we did to just kind of cleanse our palate, you know, and get back into wrestling talk later on. Yeah, that's about it. RBR Wrestling's just gonna keep trucking, and it's gonna keep going till it doesn't.
Till your announcement.
What? I have an announcement.
You said 35, age 35. There's a whole thing that you haven't. You have.
Yeah, no, I'm not telling. I'm not telling that. Not on here.
I thought that's. I mean, okay. I thought that's where you were gonna friendship, Will, but apparently not. Apparently not. The Blue Wire platform and the Chase Hounds podcast is not a big enough platform for Will William R. Washington. I guess we'll look out for it on AEW Unrestricted.
It won't be for this at this point, but yeah.
All right. Well, keep up the great work, sir. Stay safe out there. Thank you, as always, for making the time.
Of course.
All All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas podcast, and I am now joined by someone who knows far more about the Louisville Cardinals and the way to say the city of Louisville than myself, Mike Rutherford of Card Chronicle, a very good Louisville. I'm giving all kinds of the pronunciations here on this podcast about the Louisville. Mike, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. You did real well there. You have to say it like you have a mouthful of bubble gum, like you're a 9-year-old who just, you know, went too deep on that big league two, and you're just saying Louisville. That's just that's how it is. You did real well there.
Thank you. I think it was the book that I read on Patino, during quarantine. I already forgot what it was called. It was really good, but I read the word multiple times. And when you're reading, I don't know if you're like me, you say it out loud in your head. So I just got, it just was pounded into my skull, Louisville. Very good book. Not great for the program, but good book. And I forgot what it was called now. Do you know what I'm talking about? That was like 17 books ago, and I'm trying to remember what it was actually called. Rick Pitino, Louisville book. Do you know what I'm talking about?
If it's the most recent one, I can't remember the title, but it's like the Pitino My Story or whatever, where he tries to explain what went on with the FBI deal and winds up giving us like zero new details. I don't know if that's the one you're talking about.
No, he didn't write it. It was another journalist. Oh, The Last Temptation of Rick Pitino. That's what it was.
Oh, I did read that one back in the day, and that was another one that gave us like two new details, but really nothing earth-shattering.
No, but it was interesting to learn about just how Louisville became like a power in the commuter school and just changing over and everything. I thought it was really fascinating. I thought it was an interesting read. And the old GM, or the old GM, the old AD that built it there. It was fascinating about how it got to where it is. I wanted to pick your brain today, Mike, about both football and basketball, because I think Louisville is in an interesting situation in both regards. A lot of crossover, a lot of turnover, weird season for football, weird season for basketball, a lot of transfers for basketball. We'll see. Questions about Malik Cunningham and things like that. But I want to start because nothing can be normal at Louisville. Kind of like I'm in Rocky Top at Tennessee. Nothing can be normal at Tennessee. Nothing can be normal at Louisville because Scott Satterfield made a lot of waves, like where he was potentially interviewing it. Like, was there interest in other jobs? Like, is he committed to Louisville? Like, what is your not instinct, but like what is your feeling on Satterfield's happiness at Louisville at this moment?
I can tell you more about the fan base's happiness with Scott Satterfield for other jobs than I can Satterfield himself, but I like that you use the word weird a couple times there, because I keep coming back to that weird, to that word when I talk about Louisville sports and the current state of things when I'm doing my podcast or interviews or what have you. There's an odd sense around the program, and there really has been off and on since the Katina Powell stuff happened back in the fall of 2015. But with football, I think the one thing that you felt like you could hang your hat on if you're a Louisville sports fan was, you know, Scott Satterfield, good guy, culture change. He's the antithesis of Bobby Petrino, all of that stuff. And then this past December, the flirtation with South Carolina happens. He plays it off a little bit. He outright lies about it at one point. And then the stories start leaking out. Assistants are upset about it. Assistants are leaving. And if you're a Louisville fan, you're just kind of like, man, what the hell? Like, this is the one thing that we thought we could rely on, that you were going to be here for a piece of time and you weren't going to embarrass us in the same way that other coaches in the past have. And instead he does, and it comes on the heels, it's not just in poor taste, because we're in the middle of a global pandemic, and U of L, like so many other schools across the country, had to lay off a bunch of people within its athletic department and cut salaries and do all that good stuff. So even if Satterfield, like a lot of people believe, wasn't really that interested in the job, but was kind of posturing to maybe get a raise, that is a read the room situation that looks bad. And you're also coming off a really disappointing season where Louisville had a lot of buzz for potentially finishing, you know, in the top four, top three of the ACC, and they wind up only winning four games. So you've got a fan base that I think right now doesn't really know how to feel about Scott Satterfield. In year one, they overachieved dramatically. He was ACC Coach of the Year. Everybody was over the moon. And then in year two, it's sort of the exact reverse. And now heading into year three, everybody's just kind of like waiting to see what happens. And I don't know. I mean, he needs to – he, like Chris Mack, if you want to talk about the big highlight sports at U of L, is going into a year where he really, really needs to step it up. If he doesn't win, this fan base is not going to be quick to forgive. If he does, then, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones and continue to look forward with the direction of the program. But it's definitely a very strange time to be a Louisville fan.
Do you think fan base will let him, like, I guess just kind of like, oh, it's just the nature, he's just interviewing, who cares? Like, if we win, I don't really care what he's doing. Or do you think there is just some level of trust that's just permanently broken with Satterfield?
I think both. I mean, you have to understand a little bit of the Louisville fan base's mindset based on the last two decades, where every time they've had a really successful head coach, that head coach has gotten caught flirting with other schools. And then when he's sort of re-upped on his commitment to the program and said, you know, I'm staying here, I'm here to go, I'm here for good, all this stuff, they almost immediately leave for another job like a year later. It happened with Bobby Petrino the first go round, where he got caught flirting with Auburn and then said, you know, he signed this big time long-term deal and said, that was the past, Bobby, I'm here to stay for good. And then right after the Orange Bowl, signed with the Falcons, Charlie Strong, the exact same thing happens. He turns down Tennessee. He talks about how he's, you know, his word is his bond, and you know, he's not cut like that, and all this stuff that makes Louisville fans swoon. And then less than a year later, he's off to Texas. So this is a fan base that has been burned before. So I think there's definitely a lack of trust with Scott Satterfield at this point in time. But at the same time, if he comes out this year and wins 8 or 9 games, does more than a lot of people are projecting this team to do, I do think there's going to be forgiveness, just because Louisville fans are kind of, you know, cynical by nature at this point. Like, they just expect a really successful coach to leave, and they're kind of okay with that. I mean, this isn't a program that has had a whole lot of history before the last 30 years. And so I think best case scenario for Louisville football fans is you hire sort of an up-and-comer, a guy like Scott Satterfield or like Bobby Petrino when he was first hired, or like Charlie Strong when he was first hired. They kill it here for 3, 4, 5 years, and then they move on to quote-unquote greener pastures, and you bring in somebody who does the exact same thing and builds on that success. I think that's sort of the blueprint with Louisville football. It's not like basketball, where when you hire a men's basketball coach at U of L, you expect them to be here for 15, 20 years. You expect them to be lifers, unless something like what happened with Rick Pitino winds up happening. So I think the fan base, they're not going to trust Scott Satterfield if he comes out and wins 9 or 10 games, but they're still going to appreciate him. They just want to see winning football here again.
On the field, what happened in year two under Satterfield? Why did they take a step back? Why was it so frustrating? Was it just all turnovers, or was there more on the field that you saw that you were like, I did not see this coming?
The turnovers are the biggest thing, and it's such an obvious explanation that I think a lot of fans want to look elsewhere. But when you look at the difference between 2019 and 2020, statistically, there wasn't a whole lot there. Like, the offense was pretty good by and large when it came to explosive plays and when it came to just total yardage. The defense was a little bit better this past year, but still was certainly not great. But the big difference was Louisville was one of the worst. I think they actually were the worst turnover team in all of the FBS. Their turnover rate was abysmal, and every time it seemed like they got a little bit of momentum going in big games, you know, Malik Cunningham fumbled the ball, or J.V. Hawkins fumbled the ball, or there was an interception. It was just fluke play after fluke play. And that was the biggest reason why you had an 8-win team in 2019 turn into a 4-win team in 2020. There were a couple of other things. I think the play calling got a little bit bland. I think also the familiarity within the ACC when it came to Scott Satterfield and his offense certainly helped some of the teams that were caught by surprise in 2019 prepare for this team a little bit better last year. I think that came into play. But for the most part, the turnovers were just the biggest thing. And there were a lot of games where if Louisville had won the turnover battle, you feel like they would have had a chance to win the game. And that's been the biggest stat in Satterfield's tenure, is they're undefeated when they turn the ball over less than their opponent. And I think they've only won one game where they have more turnovers than their opponent, and that was the first game this past season when they played Western Kentucky. So I wish I had a more in-depth, layered answer, but the biggest explanation for why things went so bad last year, just those absurd turnover numbers.
Where are you at with Malik Cunningham? What are your expectations? Where's the fan base at with him?
I think the fan base, sort of like they are with the football program on the whole, is kind of all over the place with Malik Cunningham. There's a sense that he's been good, but not quite good enough. He does. I mean, there's a lot to like about Malik Cunningham outside of the turnovers this past season. He understands the offense really well. He gets the ball in the hands of playmakers in positions where they can, you know, turn a 7-yard catch into a 70-yard touchdown. You saw that a lot with Tutu Atwell over the last 2 years, and to a lesser extent with Jess Fitzpatrick the last couple of seasons. He also, I think, is a sort of an underrated athlete. He led all Power 5 conference quarterbacks in runs of 25 yards or more last season. He can definitely make plays in space. There weren't as many design runs specifically for him this past year as there were in 2019, and that was largely because he kept getting injured in 2019. So I think the fan base is, they're good with Malik Cunningham, but they want to see him take a step forward, because the step forward that everybody was expecting to happen last year didn't really come to fruition. He was good enough, but we were talking about him as potentially, you know, the second or third best quarterback in the ACC last year, and he was not that. There's no question about it. So you'd love to see him be a little bit more accurate when it comes to those intermediary passes. He's a really good deep ball thrower. He struggled more with those 15 to 20 yard passes over the middle of the field or to the sidelines. Decision making has been good, but not great. And then I don't know. I think that the issue you have if you're a Louisville fan right now is there's not a whole lot behind him. They haven't brought in these high rated recruits that can really push Malik Cunningham. Their backup last year was still Evan Conley, who was an Appalachian State commit before Scott Satterfield got the Louisville job. I know Joel Pass was third string, a former starter. He's moved on now. They brought in Luke McCaffrey from Nebraska, who maybe could push Cunningham a little bit, but I think they see him more as sort of an athlete who can do things outside the quarterback position. We'll find out there. But they lost Chuba Purdy to Florida State. He was the crown jewel of the 2020 recruiting class, who wound up going elsewhere. And then T-Webb, the quarterback who did come in here from last year's recruiting class, has also transferred. So I think there's a little bit of concern as far as the lack of depth in the quarterback room is concerned. But Malik Cunningham, he's going to be the guy. Like, this is his team. The coaching staff has made that very, very apparent. And if he can't get the job done, if that becomes obvious through the first 4 or 5 games of this season, I don't really know where Louisville turns. And that's, I think, where the fans' biggest concern lies right now.
Interesting. Let's pivot to basketball, Mike, because this is weird when I think about this future for basketball and just kind of where they're at with Mac and what kind of season they had at my favorite KFC Yum Center, who's not all about the Yum Center. But Jones, what do you make of Carly Jones? What is his future at Louisville right now?
Yeah, that's sort of the million-dollar question. He announced over the weekend that he's entering the NBA draft, or at least he's entering the process of the NBA draft, but maintaining his eligibility at Louisville. So he's either going to go pro or he's going to come back to Louisville. There's not going to be any sort of transfer portal thing. And because the draft has been pushed back to July, players don't have to make decisions until the first part of July. So this thing could drag out for another couple of months, and Louisville won't really know what Carlick is going to do. My understanding is that he's genuinely torn. The people who are closest to him have all sort of said, you know, one day he wakes up and talks about, you know, I'm going to be 24 next year. I want to go ahead and start making money playing this game. And then the next day he'll wake up and say, I really want to play in the NCAA tournament. I don't want this to be the way my college career ends. If you ask me to guess right now, I still think it's more likely than not that he winds up going pro, just because, you know, he spent 5 years in college. You have a limited window to get paid to play this game, whether it's in the NBA or elsewhere. Why not go ahead and make that move? But it certainly seems like he's wrestling with this decision. There's at least something of a chance that he comes back for one more season at Louisville. And if he does, I think that vaults Louisville from, you know, fringe top 25 status to legitimate top 20 team. He was that good. I mean, he was the runner-up for ACC Player of the Year. He was first-team all-conference. He did a little bit of everything for this team. He was the only reason why Louisville was squarely on the bubble when it came to early March. And if he comes back, it's pretty obvious that it's going to be a huge, huge boon for next year's team.
What do you make of next year's team right now?
It's a huge year for Chris Mack, because, you know, he comes in here. I think the fan base was understanding of the fact that he walked into a unique situation as far as Louisville's concerned, where nobody expected him to have teams that were going to compete for national titles. We all knew that the NCAA cloud was there. We all knew, we still know, that more punishments are coming. It's more difficult to recruit now at Louisville than it has been in years past. And so I think fans were going to be patient. He has an overachieving first year where they make the NCAA tournament as a 7 seed, get beat in the first round. Year two, I mean, they were preseason top 10. A lot of people thought that was a team that could compete for a national title. They kind of underachieved during the regular season and then never got a chance to make up for that in March. We'll never know how that NCAA tournament would have gone for Louisville. And if, you know, if that team made a run to the Elite Eight or to a Final Four, everybody looks at Chris Mack totally differently than they do now. If they lose in the first round, everybody is even more critical of Chris Mack than they are right now. And then this past season, look, he didn't make the NCAA tournament. Expectations weren't huge going into the year, but when you were a top 25 team halfway through the season, you had an all-conference player, you had a likely NBA draft pick in David Johnson, you had a McDonald's All-American in Samuel Williamson. The low bar, the minimum bar, is make the NCAA tournament. Louisville didn't get that done. They were the first team left out, and now fans are upset. They demanded change. Matt got rid of a couple of assistants. He's brought in three transfers. A couple of kids have transferred out of the program. You're going to have some new assistants named in the weeks ahead. And this is a gigantic season for Chris Mack, because I feel like everyone knows it's the last one where Louisville's NCAA punishments aren't going to come into play. Everyone's expecting a postseason ban to come at some point, at least one. They don't think it's going to affect next season, but it probably will affect the 2023 NCAA tournament. So if you're going to head into that period of time with the fan base feeling good about things and feeling optimistic about the future, it pretty much all has to stem from a really good 2021-22 season. And he's got to get that done. He's got a roster now with a lot of, I think, good pieces. The big issue and the big task for him is figuring out how all those pieces fit together.
We'll end here, Mike. True or false? After, let's say, summer 2022, Chris Mack and Scott Satterfield are both still head coaches at the University of Louisville.
I'm going to say true.
Okay.
I think Mack is the safer bet right now. It would take something like what we just saw at Cincinnati for Mack to get fired, because you have to remember his contract is laid out in a way to where if Louisville does get another postseason ban from the NCAA, which again, everybody's kind of assuming that that's going to happen, his contract gets extended. He gets more money. His buyout becomes even more difficult for Louisville to get out of. And I mean, the flip side is Mack leaving for another job, which he really hasn't done enough at Louisville to justify getting a higher profile job if one of those were to open up in the years ahead. So I think that Chris Mack, for better or worse, is, I don't want to say stuck here, but he's going to be Louisville's head coach for multiple seasons ahead. Again, unless this upcoming year is just a complete catastrophe. Satterfield is probably the safer bet to go somewhere else. But again, for him to be attractive for, you know, an SEC school or one of the schools back in the Carolinas where he, you know, has spent most of his life, he's going to have a really overachieving 2021 season. And I'm not sure that's going to happen. I think Louisville can be okay this year and if he can win 6 or 7 games. But if you're, I'm trying to think of an SEC school that would have a job opening, are you really going to sell your fan base on a coach who has been basically 500 over 3 seasons at an ACC school that has had a decent amount of success over the years? I think that would be a tough sell. So my guess is that Satterfield probably is going to be a guy who's here for 4 or 5, maybe 6 years total before those things start happening. And again, the other side is, does he fail hard enough that you get rid of him? I don't think that's going to happen either. I would expect both those guys to still be around here a couple summers from now.
Interesting. What can we check out from you this week at Card Chronicle or anywhere else, Mike?
Yeah, we got a new podcast up talking about the latest basketball roster changes and how Chris Mack might use the one available scholarship that he has for next year. Got some basketball recap stuff up on the website. We're also going to review spring practice and look at the new coaches on the U of L football staff coming up later this week. So check out all that good stuff over at cardchronicle.com.
All right. Well, keep up the great work. Thank you so much for making the time today. I greatly appreciate it, Mike.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.